This is the Serrano Brothers Podcast.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Serrano Brothers Podcast. Today we have Deacon Kenan Falk. Deacon, how you doing, man?
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. Doing all right.
Kenan, we are excited to have you, especially since we just spent all that time with you in Houston. But our listeners may not know who you are. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, well, I am. I'm at a congregation, ELCA congregation here in Houston called Kindred. It's a Restart congregation. Used to be an over 100-year-old Lutheran congregation called Grace Lutheran Church. Had a declining inner city population, towards the early 2000s there, dwindling membership, and they decided to close their doors and restart with a new name, new leadership. And I just happened to be kind of new back in Houston and looking for a church and got connected and was on the leadership there for the church as a council member. And then while I was working doing fundraising for a homeless clinic and, working in homeless services, but, volunteering heavily for the congregation during that time. And after about 10 years doing that, our pastor left and there was an opportunity for me to kind of come on staff while we were in an interim. And so I've slowly transitioned to doing that and working for the congregation full time now. And I'm a seminary graduate. I graduated with these guys back in the day. And so, I was just on the long journey to being ordained and being officially called in a church position.
How did you all settle on the name Kindred? Is there a story behind that?
It's a good question. Pastor Ashley, who was the Restart pastor, she pulled it from scripture. There was just this text, and now I'm blanking on what it is. But it's in our bulletin on the cover, and I'll look it up and figure out what it is. But it's the how good it is for the spirit to dwell when kindred are among each other, one of those kind of things like that. And, I think I saw her like vision board of all the different ideas, and it was like, what were some of them? Houston's the Bayou City, and we're near the Bayou. And so one of them was like Our Lady of the Bayou or something. It was all kind of creative ideas and stuff, but. That's the one she landed on, and we just all liked it and rolled with it.
So you said you're on staff there. What does staff look like at that in the congregation?
Yeah, it's a little interesting. So we'll get into it, but we have this program, Kindred Kitchen, which is an employment training program that we started. And so there's some people on that staff. But right now, as far as just the congregation goes, I'm the only kind of salaried staff member. We have a bookkeeper and other people that kind of help us out with different things. But right now it's mostly me and then the Kindred Kitchen staff.
Hey, well, let's hit pause there. Let's talk about church. What does family look like for you first?
Yeah. I am married to my lovely wife, Allison, who I was with back in seminary. You guys know her. And then I have two kiddos, Nora, almost age 13, and Holden, age 10.
Nice. Okay, so do you have any spiritual practices that you engage in?
Yeah, that's interesting that you talk about that. I just got out of therapy and we were talking about some of these things and how that's like a big goal of mine. I would really like to be kind of more disciplined in some of those practices. But having a bunch of different jobs and wearing a bunch of different hats, I've learned to be creative and try to take up more of a kind of ora et labora spiritual practice, which is kind of like the monastic sort of prayer while working philosophy.
Oh, yeah.
So this goes hand in hand with mindfulness, which is something that I've tried to practice more and more. It just kind of is really helpful for my mental health, my ADHD and all that. And so there are certain things when I'm doing them around the building, I try to turn them into kind of a spiritual practice. And so part of what we do a lot of is prepare food. And so if I am doing kind of like rote food prep activities, like chopping a ton of vegetables, I kind of turn that into a mindfulness practice and kind of a prayerful time. Same with washing dishes. And so it kind of just becomes like that, mind-body connection of like thinking about the things that I'm touching and the tactileness of it, and you know, kind of reminding myself of the work that I'm doing is in service to others, and it's just a very kind of grounding thing for me. And I would like to say that I completely clear my mind and become this kind of monk type person who is meditating. It's not necessarily that at all, but like,
right.
I think any type of mindfulness is good and healthy. And so, you know, beyond that, I always told people like, oh, I don't know when I can meditate. There's not really like a good time and place. And now that was in my old job. Now I have a job where I'm literally like, there's a sanctuary right there that's totally quiet. I could go sit in there and meditate, but like, I don't always have time for that. So I've gotten into this practice and I'd love to get better and do more stuff. But for now, it's been really helpful.
Have you ever read The Practice of the Presence of God by Brother Lawrence?
I don't think so.
Oh, man, you are embodying exactly.
Totally.
I mean, word for word, what Brother Lawrence talks about. And he was a monastic, and he talks about like the spiritual discipline. I think he was a cobbler, right, Josh? Like fixing shoes.
Yeah, but he also did it like washing dishes too.
He talks about washing dishes and how he is experiencing God by just placing himself in the work and in the presence of God while doing that work. My friend, you are a modern day Brother Lawrence. but you're talking exactly about what he talked about. And so that's really cool to hear that you haven't read his book. Because you're just doing this kind of naturally, you know, you're just kind of embodying that already.
Well, you know, it's something my therapist and my internship when I was going through candidacy committee, they all kind of had similar ideas about this. So I know it's, you know, it's a thread that's out there and a lot of people do, but and it's even, you know, like we're an inner city church and there are a lot of people who, you know, will be on our porch and camp on the property and things like that. And we have to kind of maintain that and make sure things are safe. But a lot of it involves me walking around the building pretty regularly to make sure there's not, you know, trash and things out there that don't need to be out there. And it can be a pretty gross job sometimes, but like even trying to keep that mindset of like, hey, I get to be outside. I get to walk. I get to listen to birds while I'm maybe picking up human waste. But there's something, something to that. Yeah.
Let me ask you about that. Like, so, you know, I have a, you know, mine is not inner city at all, but we have a big homeless population that we, you know, interact with. How do you keep yourself from becoming angry or bitter or resentful at having to clean up human feces and the constant trash and, you know, kind of what goes along with serving an inner city population or, you know, people who are unhoused?
I wouldn't say that I do keep myself from those things. I mean, there are times where I do get angry and bitter, and I have to remind myself that like ministry in the margins is messy, and it's incredibly complicated, and it's not just this wholesome like, oh, we're doing good things and we're helping people. I mean, when you get down into the lives of people who are struggling, I mean, you see all the warts and everything that the, you know, there's going to be a lot of beauty in, you know, building those relationships and trying to bring hope to these people. But there's a lot of frustration and a lot of complications. And I think it's just important to kind of remember that and realize that and know that that's reality. And that's why, you know, people don't always do this work or it's not attractive. You know, we've talked about that before. Like it's when you have a congregation that has a lot of people in the margins, it is not the most marketable or like, you know, family friendly, you know, easiest sort of pitch to sell to people. Like I remember one time a new family was in, they had kids and we practiced dinner church. So we all sit at a table and this family sat down right next to someone that I knew sometimes is in active psychosis. And she like threw up into an empty pint glass and left it on the table and walked away. And I was like, that family is never coming back, you know?
Yeah.
It's, and it's really frustrating and hard. And, but you know, you kind of pick your battles, and we have chosen to be a congregation that's going to kind of lean into this identity of being, a place where people who are maybe in mental health crises or in different crises can feel comfortable and not feel that pressure of like, you have to put on airs and you have to act a certain way when you're here. And I'm not saying that other congregations, you know, do that. I mean, I know there are some that do that, but in some places there's just kind of a natural pressure of like feeling conformity to kind of, you know, be a little more proper. And we definitely don't have that going on at Kindred, but it's not without its detractions and frustrations at times.
Yeah, that's awesome. Do you, what made you kind of pull the trigger and become a deacon? What was that kind of process for you?
It was a long, almost 20-year process, but I originally thought I wanted to be a pastor. And after going to seminary, I always heard these people saying, I had to go to seminary because I tried to resist it for so long until, like, you know, I couldn't ignore the voices anymore. And when I was in seminary, most of the voices were like, you don't want to do this. You don't know. I'm not sure this is for you. Like, I really was like hearing the call to not be a pastor, even though I was really interested in the work that the church was doing. I was interested in my studies and the things I was learning. My identity just wasn't lining up in that pastoral role and identity. And so that's why at the time when I graduated, they hadn't consolidated the rosters of lay ministries, what they called at the time. There was AIMS, there were diaconal ministers, deaconesses, all these things. And I was interested in diaconal ministry, but it was not a very formed idea. And so, and my candidacy committee, my synod had never had one. They didn't know what it was. So that's why I just kind of floundered and did a bunch of other things and just sort of existed in the nonprofit world, thinking eventually I'd get back to this process and we'd figure it out. In staying active in churches, there were, you know, a few people along the way who kept me engaged. And I think I restarted candidacy again like 5 or 6 years ago and was like, okay, we're ready to do your internship. And I was like, well, I'm still like a grant writer for a homeless clinic. I don't know if I have time to like figure out an internship. So again, it just kind of died off and it, you know, went for so long that I had to restart it again. So I've really done like my entrance and endorsement essays 3 times now and finally got to do the like approval essay this last time. Got psych evaluations 3 times. So, and I joke too that like each one of those evaluations, I kind of cared less and less about what they were going to find out about me. The first one, they're going to find out there's something wrong with me. And by the third one, I'm like, hey doc, I'm taking this as like a free therapy session. Let's talk about some stuff. And like, but yeah, you know, so, I mean, I was going to be doing this work anyway, cause it's what I was called to and, or felt called to. And it, but I think it perfectly aligns with the idea of what a deacon is, this bridge between the church and the world's great needs. So, here I am.
Let's talk a little bit about Dinner Church. I got to experience it at your ordination, and I got to admit, I was a little skeptical of it. I didn't really know what it was going to be, what it was going to be about, or how it would flow. Because when I've seen outlines of it before, I'm like, how does that work? And it didn't really, you know, I just didn't get it. Uh-huh. And then I experienced it, and I thought, holy cow, this was excellent. It was just really beautifully put together. Did you come up with that liturgy for Dinner Church?
I will say, I think Pastor Ashley borrowed a ton of it from St. Lydia's, which is kind of like one of the flagship dinner churches in the ELCA. They're in Brooklyn. And I know they've borrowed things here and there. I didn't realize how much we borrowed until recently. I went and looked at theirs and was like, oh yeah, we do all this stuff. But I mean, essentially the idea is you follow the same ordo, but you just like stick a 15 to 20 minute, you know, dining experience in there where the table of communion is extended sort of into a full meal where, you know, you're really taking that concept of like a table and the power of a shared table and what that means and what that means for community, for communion with God and one another. And you sit down and you break bread and you talk to the person across from you who you may or may not know or who may or may not be of the same socioeconomic class, race, you know, all these different things. We bring a lot of different people together. And there's something very powerful in that. And it has gone beautifully. I mean, I was hesitant about it too. I think when we came up with the idea, we were like, well, we'll try this out. We'll see, you know, how it goes. We'll learn something from it. It probably won't stick. And we have done it every Sunday pretty much since we started, you know, barring COVID. And we, even when there's Sundays when we don't meet, we still provide food for folks. We pass out food because, you know, we've become a sense of food security for some people. And that's been kind of a tricky thing as well, because we don't want it to be sort of a bait and switch kind of thing where, like, you have to participate in our worship service in order to get food, you know? And I think at times there are people that definitely are there, I think, just because they want the food. I mean, I can't assume, but I see that, or I sense that, and there may be things they're getting out of it that, you know, I can't tell, but they're not maybe super engaged. They're just there for the food. And we're totally fine with that. Like, we want that to be, you know, a source of comfort for them, because it's an act of service. But the idea behind it, though, is more than that. You know, it's about sharing a meal with someone and what that means. Grace Place, which is an organization that our predecessor church, Grace, started, is an outreach program. It's a youth drop-in program for youth in the neighborhood who are experiencing homelessness or have experienced homelessness or generational poverty. And there's a big focus on youth of color and LGBTQ youth, you know, as it just happens to be, like, the youth homeless population has a much higher representation of LGBTQ folks, you know, and that may be more true in Texas than it is where you guys are, but there are just a lot of people who have been abandoned by their families when they came out, and they don't have that support structure in those transitional years between childhood and adulthood. And so they practice a family style meal 3 times a week. And that's really what they're all about, is like a seat at their table. This is the support that, you know, these kids are missing out on by not having that family support. Grace Place provides that. They all sit down, have a meal family style. They have mentors sit at the table with them and kind of provide those positive adult role model, you know, experiences for the youth. And so I think it's interesting that, and they're still in our building. They're their own 501(c) now, but we work very closely together. And we always talk about how we're two organizations who understand the power of a shared table and a shared meal means. So,
yeah, it really seems like you're, like, the work that you're doing all revolves around, like, food and including people with food, right? So there's that Grace Place, there's Kindred, and then you have Kindred Kitchen too, right?
Yeah, and I'll talk about that. Go ahead.
Tell us about Kindred Kitchen. How did that get started?
Kitchen?
Let's get to that. Well, just kind of the background is, when Kindred had started, you know, we knew Grace Place and we worked together, and there was some overlap between our populations of youth that were coming to Grace Place and also coming to dinner church. Grace Place also has an age limit, so you age out at 25, and a lot of those kids would come to dinner church because they couldn't, you know, come to Grace Place anymore. And the church saw this need and this population that we wanted to help serve. And so we asked Grace Place, like, what is something, you know, you wished you could do more, but you don't have time or resources to do? Like, what's the biggest need among your youth? And they said jobs, like employment. You know, I worked at a healthcare clinic for homeless folks, and that was more of the general population. And the general population of homelessness, like, health needs, mental health needs are kind of the biggest, you know, issue they're tackling. But for youth, you know, they're younger, they're healthier. Really, they just kind of need someone to take a chance on them and help give them a stepping stone to kind of achieve independence. They have so much more potential to kind of turn their lives around. And so we got to thinking about it. We're like, I don't know how we could help with that necessarily. You know, we can't hire people. But somehow, somewhere along the way, we learned about these food-based employment programs that, take youth and give them classroom training, essentially like a culinary school training, and then have a social enterprise component where they run a cafe or something like that. And the students get hands-on training as they're working in the business, and then you place them with employment partnership positions, you know, when they graduate. And so we did some consulting with a group called Fair Start out of Seattle that, you know, does a lot of these programs. We did a lot of like workshops, brainstorming sessions. We brought in people from the industry, people who serve in homeless services, people who have been homeless, people in the restaurant industry, people in the church. And we just kind of put our heads together and sort of fleshed out this idea and came up with Kindred Kitchen. And so it's been quite a few years in the making, but we just started our first real pilot class in October. We got some funding from HUD that came through our local Coalition for the Homeless. That's youth homeless diversion funding. And it helped pay for stipends and helped pay for our teaching for four students to go through the program. It's 12 weeks. They usually have classroom time in the afternoon, and in the morning we're preparing meals, and we had a catering contract to provide meals for these homeless youth agencies around town. So there were three of them. We provided meals basically every day, and that gave them something to do. And it went really great. I mean, there were a lot of challenges, a lot of things we learned. We called it our pilot class because we're, you know, going to learn a lot from this and kind of change some things up after that. But, yeah. You know, I think we really impacted these four young people's lives, and we hope to keep it going, keep looking for more funding. And eventually we would like to turn the sanctuary where we have dinner church into a cafe, like a brick and mortar cafe that's open all the time. And we'd really like to operate as kind of like an LGBTQ safe space in the neighborhood, like a cafe. We're kind of in the ground zero of like Houston's gayborhood, Montrose. I don't know if y'all noticed that. It's kind of like the Castro in San Francisco. Houston has the Montrose. And people talk about how most of the LGBTQ safe spaces in Houston are bars, and that is not necessarily the best space for a lot of people, especially people under 21 or people in recovery. So that's kind of one of our big dreams too, is to just become a space where we can host events and do different things for the community. So yeah, lots of ideas, lots of room to grow and continue. Yeah. Building up.
So with Kindred Kitchen, is the class that you're doing, cause you have a food truck.
Mm-hmm,
Is it all done in the food truck? Or are you using the church's kitchen? Like, is the food truck just like a dispensary? I don't know, to give out food.
Yeah.
How does all that work?
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, so the food truck is essentially a mobile commercial kitchen, but because it's a catering contract, technically we don't have to work out of that the food truck. So we use the church kitchen, which is a fine kitchen, but it's not quite up to commercial grade. We don't have like the right, you know, plumbing and you know, vent hood and that sort of stuff. But the food truck is used mostly for like pop-up events, catering events, and kind of promotions. So we take it on the road, we go to different churches sometimes, and like I'll preach and then we do breakfast tacos or something like that.
Cool.
But people ask us, you know, and the vast majority of our catering clients are other nonprofits. And so, but you know, we have other organizations that are missionally aligned. A lot of people know about us, and it's kind of been a lot of word of mouth, and a food truck is a great visual way to kind of market yourself. That being said, it's really kind of a pain to operate a food trailer, especially if you want to have like regular cafe hours. In Houston, you have to take it to the commissary every day to get fresh water and do all that. And it's just not ideal for what we're trying to do. So our big goal would be to get our brick and mortar kitchen up to commercial grade and continue to use the trailer for that. But kind of our bridge will probably be using the food trailer as our commercial kitchen and still opening the cafe, with goals of getting the commercial kitchen, you know, done as quickly as possible.
That's really cool. Now, yeah. You and I were having a conversation last week about do you also? Yeah, I'm trying to remember how the conversation went, but did you take some of these students to like different restaurants to have them experience food? Is that something you do with them too?
Well, the idea is we try to do kind of like experiential field trips, so to speak, when we have time. So, you know, some of these students have never experienced certain cuisines or fine dining experiences. So like the first thing we did was take them out to a quasi-fine dining restaurant. Like, we still try to keep it somewhat casual. We don't want it, like, super stuffy where they don't know which fork to use and that kind of thing. But
totally.
We took them out for a really, and they're a really good organization. And they ended up, all of them staged at that restaurant later, which is a culinary term for an internship that you do for, like, a couple of days. So we got them into stage there, and they got to, they came back with terms that I had never heard of, you know, telling me, how, what do you call, like, segmenting citrus? And I don't even remember what it's called now, but they were like, that's called this, chef, you know? So yeah, we do that. Like, Houston has some really neat ethnic enclaves. And so we try to take them to, you know, like our Chinatown, our Asia town. You know, we've got a big, like, Nigerian neighborhood, Korean town, you know, there's the Hispanic parts of town. We didn't hit them all, but and we did like a farmer's market. There's like a big farm market. And so we went out there and bought some things and practiced our food Spanish. And, you know, they were like, we want to make enchiladas. So, like, we're going to go buy the canned enchilada sauce. And I'm like, nope, this is an opportunity. We're going to go out and buy all the ingredients to, like, make mole ourselves, and we're going to do it. And so, you know, we try to broaden their horizons however we can. We're not just trying to keep them in the back room chopping potatoes all day. Although they
I mean, what a great opportunity, right? To have them stage at a restaurant and like, they're away from you and from maybe other people they know. And then it's like, all right, it's time for you to, like, get a different experience, right?
And learn
how to be professional. And, you know, that's a really cool thing, I think, to do.
And our goal is to, I mean, so far we hired back, you know, some of our graduates, some of them went on to college, but we want to maintain relationships with lots of higher end restaurants so we can place them in places that are career stepping stones. You know, we're not just going to try to get them a job at fast food places, because that they could do that without our experience. And we're trying to form relationships with other employment partners that aren't just restaurants, because the idea behind this program is not that we are making little chefs. We are training people how to be employable. We're just using food as kind of the element of, that we use to teach them. It gives them the framework to learn how to show up at work on time, how to be responsible, how to take constructive criticism, how to be coachable, you know, all these things. We could do it teaching them auto mechanics too. I just think food's a lot more fun. But, you know, not all of them are going to be naturally talented chefs. We're also going to, the other thing about having the cafe is that'll give us the ability to teach them some front of house experience, you know, back of house in the kitchen, front of house out, customer facing. You know, when we're doing food truck events, we try to all give them time at the register, but just that customer service interface, that's a whole other experience that opens up a lot of different employment opportunities. So it's not all just about cooking, but to us, it's, I mean, hospitality is kind of the central focus. And almost any job that's customer facing, you're going to need hospitality experience, I think. And that really is kind of the central focus of Kindred and everything we do. I remember talking to another congregation where they run a healthcare clinic. So the pastor is halftime pastor, halftime clinic CEO. And he talked about their concept was like a wagon wheel where healing was at the center of everything they do, and all their different ministries were spokes of that. So, like, you know, their adult education, their worship, all that was centered around healing. And when I was talking to him, I was like, oh, Kindred could do this too. It's hospitality. It's a table, and all the different ministries are like chairs around the table, you know? So, like, Grace Place is one, Kindred Kitchen, Dinner Church, all these different things that we do, our clothing pantry, our food pantry, clothing closet, all that stuff. And that's really kind of helped center our mission in a way, and help us figure out, you know, what's the stuff we want to focus on going forward and what is kind of mission creep for us.
I really love that idea of a table. That's really great, man. That's really good.
Yeah.
And how did you decide on food? Because, you know, you talked about, like, healthcare and, like, being a mechanic, but you chose food. Was that something that, like...
You probably can't tell, but I like to eat, Jeremy. I don't know about you, but
I think we all do, my friend. I think we all do. Yeah.
Houston is a very restaurant focused town. It's a lot of our big personalities are chefs. We have, you know, and they're all very, like, kind people. It's not this very like cutthroat New York, you know, if you're not the best, you're out. Everybody kind of works together. We have this foundation here called Southern Smoke that works to provide health insurance and benefits for people in the restaurant industry, because that's something that's lacking in, you know, most restaurants. So everybody tries to help everybody out. It's kind of like a big family. And our congregation was right next to the guy who started that foundation's big restaurant, the one that got the James Beard Award, that all the Houston travel food shows come to his restaurant. He's helped us with a few things. Chris Shepherd in Underbelly was the restaurant. He let me use his big, giant pig smoker where you like butterfly the pig and put it in this rack, and then you can flip the whole thing over coals and stuff.
That's cool.
So, it's part of the kind of just the vibe of the neighborhood we're in and the town that we are. And it's a beautiful way to kind of celebrate the diversity of Houston. We are right after you guys in the Bay Area. I think we're the most racially diverse county in the country, right after y'all. And especially when it comes to food, I think I was telling you guys, there's only like one or two countries that don't have their cuisine represented in a restaurant in Houston. So it's just a great way of showing the diversity of this city, and kind of the, just kind of what Houston is all about. And we try to, our community at Kindred reflects a lot of that diversity. And, we had one of our students was from Uganda. You know, there's a lot of international flair in our food and kind of fusion, a lot of fusion of like Creole, Southern, Mexican, you know, everything you can imagine. Vietnamese.
When we were in Houston,
yeah.
The one thing I really noticed was the amount of what you're saying, the amount of different kinds of spots, but also like hip spots. Like everything was like, felt like there was like lots of new restaurants redone restaurants. And so I did experience Houston as a very foodie town.
Yeah. But it's always kind of compared to Austin, which to me, I mean, I love Austin, went to school there, lived there for a while, but it's kind of like the too trendy part. It's like East LA, Austin, and Houston is kind of, in my mind, the more like genuine, kind of down to earth, but we're still really cool too. People just don't know about us. So it's kind of like underground cool. I want people to continue to think that Houston is just this grimy oil town that's all strip malls. It is a lot of that, but I kind of love the fact that it's underrated.
Jeremy, you probably don't know this, but Kenan can throw down with the food, man. If you were to ask me what I think his spiritual discipline is, I think it's cooking, because I think spends a little, you know, and making drinks. You make a mean cocktail, my friend. I think you like to spend time in the kitchen, right? Uh-huh. Like you just generally like to do that.
For sure. For sure.
So it seems like you're. So it goes hand in hand together.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess it was kind of one of my skills and my talents. So that was part of it as well. But yeah.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. So what else about, anything else about Kindred Kitchen you want us to know?
No, just check us out on socials. We're trying to revamp our website. Kindred, we're trying to revamp our website. You know, we're just getting started. We're still a startup. We're trying to get our name out there. I was a grant writer for 10 years. So like now that we've got one pilot class under our belt, I'm going to try to take some time to kind of hit the bricks out there doing fundraising and writing some grants and getting all that figured out. So, you know, if you're looking to support an organization that helps kind of a unique, vulnerable population, check us out. But yeah, we're up and coming. But I think, we're doing it.
What's the website for people, and what's your
kitchenmontrose.org, and then the church is kindredmontrose.org.
kindredkitchenmontrose.org.
Yeah, if you Google that on Instagram, Facebook, you'll find us there too.
And we'll put a link to it on our socials as well.
Yeah, great.
We close all of our podcasts when we interview people with some questions. Are you ready for them?
Let's do it.
All right. Probably so, not. Which food could you eat every day?
Vietnamese food, probably, like a banh mi. Yeah, sure.
What's your favorite movie genre?
Sci-fi, I think.
Salty, sweet, or savory?
Ooh, That's tough. I guess savory, like umami. Yeah. Salty and savory.
In addition to the Bible, what book would you take with you on a deserted island?
Probably an Anthony Bourdain book. I just love his writing and his attitude and outlook on life. Yeah.
What fills your cup?
Time with my family. Spending time with my family, doing cool stuff or not doing anything.
What depletes your cup?
Some social situations where I have to kind of put on airs or act differently than how I want to act. That really drains me.
What's your favorite holy play?
I think I've said this to other people before. I used to go out to Mount Tam a lot when we were in grad school, and I always said if I was a ghost, I was going to come back and haunt that one hill that overlooks the Golden Gate Bridge and the bay and everything.
What is one piece of good advice that you've been given?
Don't structure your life based on how you see other people living. Don't be too self-critical. Don't judge yourself based on how you see other people living their lives. Just kind of be true to yourself and support your own kind of creativity in the way you function in the world.
What does rest look like for you?
Cooking a good meal and feeding it to the people I love.
Mm. And on that last day, when you enter heaven, what do you hope God will say to you?
Oh, that's a tough one, man. Welcome home, I guess, you know, that's welcome home. Like that's the ultimate homecoming.
Friends, Kenan Falk and Josh and I are good friends, and Josh and I are so excited to have him here on this podcast. Check him out. Kindred Kitchen in Houston, Kindred Montrose. Thanks for coming on, Kenan. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me. This was fun.
This is the Serato Brothers Podcast. See you next time.